You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, January 10th, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest. Some time ago on Radio Free Northwest, I promised you all I would address the conviction of James Fields for the Charlottesville incident in 2017. Today I'm going to make good on that promise, but before I do, I need to make certain things clear and ask a huge favor of all the listeners. I've inherited Harold's role in white nationalism, and among other things, that role is to say what needs to be said, no matter how badly people don't want to hear it. Today will be no different, and just so I'm clear, I do not relish the fact that I'm likely to upset quite a few people. I have to say what I have to say, and I want to make it very plain why I'm going to say that. To be as straight up as possible with you, it's about time people started listening to what Harold had to say. The entire alt-right practically had a field day of not listening to things Harold had to say, and the James Fields situation is a good example of what happens when Harold's advice is ignored. In order to get this point across, I'm going to address the way things are with laws and our situation in general in the United States today. I am not making any claims about how I think things should be or how white people ought to be treated or anything of the sort. Please understand this, because I'm going to make some very, very uncomfortable remarks about our collective reaction to what went on to, granted, something that should never have happened to James Fields regardless. Even so, I would like everyone to try and focus on the point I'm making, rather than some of the things I'm saying that you may not agree with. I ask this because, again, I'm talking about legal realities rather than my own personal opinions about these things. And further, a lot of you are going to feel I'm throwing people under the bus. I am. I fully am. You're going to understand why, though. Before you get cross with me, please listen. Okay, so if I read this right, James Fields was convicted last year of first-degree murder. Now that's special, because it's not like he set out to kill anybody. Even so, there was plenty of evidence for a first-degree murder conviction. Now that's super, super special. I'm going to explain why that's super, super special, because this might be one of the most important things we ever say on Radio Free Northwest. To get most of the important items out of the way, I want to make it perfectly clear that, one, it's true, James Fields is not one of us. Shortly after this incident happened, in summer 2017, the alt-right Twitter sphere managed to uncover proof that James Fields has a Jewish grandparent. I believe it was one of his grandmothers. And we know the proof was perfectly good because many people on Twitter viewed it and made it plain that he's one of us even if he is Jewish and we need to defend him. The alt-right, true to its own, well, crapulence, managed to jettison standards at the first convenient opportunity. That is sadly characteristic of the alt-right, and I will move on. Now, it's true, I haven't provided the proof of this. One, I did see it with my own eyes, and two, I actually went looking for it, but it appears all of those Twitter accounts got wrecked. Thanks, Twitter. The fact of the matter is, though, Harold and I have repeatedly addressed the subject of proof and how white nationalists don't actually care about proof, even when you have good physical evidence of somebody's Jewishness or their bad behavior, and so on and so forth. Quite frankly, I'm not going to spend time on that. So, important item number two is to give accolades to whoever told me this on Gab, and I don't remember who it was. We're getting pulled into current events here, and we shouldn't be. It's not what Harold would want, and it shouldn't be what I want either. I can't remember who it was who pointed that out. Kudos to you, because good observation. Even so, there's a lesson here, so I am taking time to get into it. Important item number three. I have not seen proof I consider convincing that this was some sort of false flag event. I could be completely wrong about that. For the record, I respect conspiracy theory, I just didn't spend that much time on this. I'm not worried about it either way because there, as I keep saying, is a very, very important lesson here, and it's not immediately obvious, so bear with me. Important item number four. The Northwest Front and Radio Free Northwest came out firmly against Unite the Right for a number of reasons, not the least of them ideological, but also practical. I feel no particular need to defend James Field because he's not one of us. Even so, the fact of the matter is that you can make a very good case, and as much as I insult the alt-right, they actually did this very well, you can make a very good case that he's not guilty of anything at all, excepting maybe reckless driving. It's true he was being attacked and felt the need to flee. It's also true that contrary to what the media tells you, if I understand everything that's been dug up correctly, the woman he killed wasn't actually killed by him. In fact, he didn't even directly hit her with his car. She was in very poor health due to her weight and other things and died at the hospital, if I understand the news sources I found correctly. Again, I could be wrong about that because some of those details seem to be scarce, but as much as I hate saying this, kudos also to the alt-right for digging up the reality on that. Just so I'm crystal clear, I'm bringing this point up so you can't say I'm being unfair. If I were being completely, completely objective and I had to judge the case for myself, you'd slap the guy with community service for reckless driving, purely my opinion, based on what I understand. Having spent just enough time to make myself crystal clear on where I stand in general, none of that really matters because he was convicted of first-degree murder, and the lesson I keep referring to is in how that conviction took place based on what I've read in the media. That conviction took place because first-degree murder, and I happen to know something about this from some firearms training I took to get my first conceal permit, isn't so much about targeting a specific person as it is premeditated use of lethal force. That's important, and I'll get into this now. This point in particular is where I'm seeking to avoid an argument with you all. Again, I'm talking about legal realities as they pertain to everyone's situation currently, not how I think things should be or not how I think you should think things should be. I hope that's perfectly clear. What I'm about to tell you is related to training I receive from law enforcement and legal professionals who have trained in this field specifically, such that they were qualified to give the state-required training that I took. Because I found this information so odd, I've stayed up to speed on it, and it's still relevant, and it's very pertinent to what happened to James Fields. First-degree murder does not require a particular target. It only requires that you plan to deploy lethal force ahead of time. Here's an example. Without getting rambly, I'll ask you to imagine this scenario. You're going somewhere, like a protest, say, which I'll bring up another news story about in just a few minutes, or a dangerous part of town, or some place where you think someone might want to hurt you. What's wrong with that, right? If you're legally allowed to go there, and you're legally allowed to defend yourself, wherever this is, and you're legally allowed to possess a firearm with which to defend yourself, you say, no big deal, I'll strap on. Sorry, there's a problem here. To an outside party, it looks an awful lot like you decided to bring along a lethal weapon in order to use because you expected violence. Again, please understand me, I'm not talking about the way I think it should be, I'm talking about the way it is right now. Bear in mind, I was told this by law enforcement and legal professionals who studied this field such that they were qualified to tell me this. I am not making this up. I am not sharing any of my perspective. I'm not a lawyer. Please bear with me and understand why I'm bringing this up. Right about now, I get the sense many of you are so outraged and indignant that you're screaming at your devices because you can't stand what I've just said. And you would be completely right. The trouble is, everything I've said is a matter of reality rather than how things should be. It should not be the case that protecting yourself because you're going someplace dangerous means you're guilty of first-degree murder if you end up defending yourself. But that's not the situation we're in, and it's very, very important that you all realize this. I was being told this again by law enforcement and legal professionals in a very, very conservative part of a very conservative state the first time I took this training. But why? Why would I spend so much time making this point? According to all the media I have been able to find, following James Field's conviction, he broadcasted his intent to be violent. He had premeditated aggression on his mind, according to things he said himself on social media. And that, according to again all of the media I've been able to find, is what sealed his fate. Now, just to drive the point home, I do not believe he's guilty of first-degree murder. He's not guilty, objectively, of anything other than bad driving, which, for everything I've been able to find, he had a reason to have engaged in regardless. Even so, the James Field incident is oddly similar to something which took place at a Richard Spencer speaking engagement not too long after Charlottesville, and I need to bring that case up because it's almost exactly the same thing, only with tiny details permuted. Observe. In mid-October 2017, Richard Spencer had a speaking engagement at the University of Florida in Gainesville, and following that speaking engagement, three men were arrested after one of them fired shots at a crowd of protesters after the other two encouraged him to, quote, kill them, unquote. This is a problem, and we need to talk about why. After this became a national news item, a day after it occurred, I got into quite the argument on Twitter, and please, again, I'm trying to avoid that argument this time around. I'm not making these things up, and I'm not referencing my own opinion, I'm just telling you how experts in the field see this right now. Were they defending themselves? Well, objectively, yes, but again, legally and objectively are almost never the same thing. The fact of the matter is, these guys did exactly what I described in that scenario. They went someplace where they had a reasonable expectation of being attacked, even if they weren't doing anything wrong by being there, and they brought a weapon along and used it. Bad plan, guys. Bad, bad plan. This entire incident is doubly ridiculous because one of the other men who did not fire a weapon is a former prison inmate. You would think he'd have some incentive for avoiding these situations altogether because, guess what, you ought to know it's way too easy to get roped into things that didn't really happen and, oh look, murder charges. Now granted, in this case it was not a, to the best of my knowledge, first-degree murder charge because it did genuinely appear to be spontaneous, but this could easily, based on everything I've been told by experts in the field, no matter how any of you feels about it, have turned into a first-degree murder charge because, again, this is exactly that scenario I described. It's in everyone's best interests that none of us ever repeat these actions. By that, I mean a couple different things. Of course, you don't go to public demonstrations because they've never produced a useful white nationalist political outcome and they only get people outed. Of course, Radio Free Northwest, the Northwest Front, Harold Covington, and I have always been opposed to those things as long as the Northwest Front has been a thing. It goes without saying, but I figured I'd say it in case someone new is listening. But more importantly, each of these individuals, James Fields and the three others in that later incident, chose to put themselves in a position they did not need to be in, and James Fields especially broadcast, even if he was joking of some sort, an intent to do harm to others. That is probably what sealed his fate, because I note that his initial charges were nothing like first-degree murder. A favorite pastime of the alt-right as an entity was ignoring advice and pleadings for more caution from white nationalist 1.0s, as they were called, and there was a particular emphasis on ignoring advice coming from Harold Covington. I know that because the scuttlebutt following Unite the Right in 2017 contained, among other things, admissions, in particular, from Andrew Anglin and Richard Spencer, that everything Harold had been trying to say to them, as individuals and to all of us collectively, were very important and we should have listened. We see where ignoring Harold got us. One of Harold Covington's most important lessons is that you don't make threats, and you don't make jokes in the form of threats, and you don't run your mouth, be it in person, electronically, on the phone, or anywhere else. You just don't, and the fate of James Fields should be a perfectly good object lesson as to why. In contrast, though, the alt-right made it perfectly plain, especially those who were outed as a result of their participation in these ill-advised political rallies, that they were just there because things were fun. Again, you may all think I'm throwing these people under the bus simply to make a point, and actually I am. I wouldn't be able to use them as object lessons if I weren't. It's unfortunate, but at this point, it's appropriate. You see, whatever else you think the alt-right may have done, it did not come up with a plan to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, and that's the takeaway here. You see, many of the things Harold Covington tried to impart through the latter portions of his life to the rest of white nationalism is how to avoid things which must not happen to us as individuals and as a movement so that we can edify ourselves with everything else he had to say, such that in 100 years there will be some white people somewhere on this planet. As yet, we have not listened to him the way we needed to. Let's change that, please.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing the Black Hand, the history of the secret Serbian nationalist group, and this is by the Charles River editors. Now, this is a concise text that deals with events leading up to the assassination of the Archduke, which sparked the First World War. So in the early 1800s, Serbia was trying to come out from under Muslim influence. And in 1806, they were doing very well under Caradora, who had the title of the Grand Vassal. And there was reestablishment of churches and Serbian schools. Now, in these days, some of the Serbs were venturing into Hungary, and they were establishing ties with Russia. And by 1867, Serbia was gaining some degree of independence. But in 1878, Austro-Hungary was really taking charge of the Ottoman Empire, and you had the Treaty of Berlin. Now, at this point, King Obrenović became the monarch in Serbia, and like a lot of monarchs, he was connected to the Emperor Franz Joseph. Now, this was also a time of shifting alliances with regard to Germany and Austro-Hungary, because in 1879, Russia was dropped from a German-Austro-Hungarian alliance, and Austria was setting aside its differences with Italy. Now, to make matters even slightly worse in some respects, in 1890, Kaiser Wilhelm II persuaded Bismarck to resign. And one of the things that Wilhelm decided to do was he did not reinstate something called a reinsurance policy, which was a kind of alliance with Russia. And as a result, Russia signed with France, and France would then sign with Britain. So this seems really unfortunate as we know now, looking back at it, because at this point, Germany is really framed by enemy states and started to be in an arms race with England. Now, the founder of this organization called the Black Hand was a Serb by the name of Dimitri Jevic, and he was something of a firebrand who went directly from what was the equivalent of high school at that time and place, and he went straight into the military academy in Serbia. Also, the Austro-Hungarian government did themselves no favors by banning the feast day of St. Sava. Now, this is what motivated a Serb by the name of Pasic to create a political group called the Radical Party, and this was a group that favored parliamentary democracy in general over monarchy and certainly over Obrenović. Now, this King Obrenovic was interested in improving public facilities. And while that sounds like a very good thing to do, this Dmitry Jevic was angry with Obrenovic for raising taxes, as well as, I'm sure, his tendency to cooperate with Austria. Now, the successor to Obrenovic was King Alexander, and he actually decided to ban the Radical Party in 1893 from holding any kind of public office. As a result, Alexander was not favored by the Radical Party, and he would end up surviving an assassination attempt that would be made in 1899. Now, I'm sure as Alexander was looking around, he became concerned about the position of monarchs, and so he would restore the Serbian constitution to an earlier version. And another bone of contention was this question of whether the Obrenovic line or the Karađorđević line should rule. And in January of 1903, Peter Kordova was restored to the family crown. Now, Peter was much more westernized than the other monarchs, and he really wanted Slavic countries to get out of the influence of Austro-Hungarian rule. But, of course, Austro-Hungary didn't like that because they lost out economically. So, in 1908, Austro-Hungary reasserted itself in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, at this point, this caused even more radicalization, and there was someone by the name of Z. Radjic. This individual, who I'm assuming is also Serbian, attempted to assassinate General Varisin. And like so many of these assassination attempts, this would end up being botched, and it would end up in essentially martyrdom for Zarađic. And that might be a historical side note, but what ended up happening as well is there was this other Serb by the name of Princip, and he was highly inspired by this martyrdom. He started visiting the grave of this Zarađic, and he started meditating on this and decided that he was also going to get radicalized. Now, at this point, in addition to the Radical Party and the Black Hand, you also had a group called the People's Defense and a group called Young Bosnia. They were all itching for some dire action. And of course, you still had this Dmitry Jevic, who was really itching to assassinate Emperor Franz Joseph, but he'd really pretty much settle for anybody. And for a while, he considered possibly assassinating the Inspector General for Austro-Hungary. And this was because this Inspector General had caused a government shutdown. So there were different people getting involved in this. Sometimes it was ideological, nationalistic. Sometimes it was economic. People who felt that they'd lost money. There were all kinds of motives. And they were always trying to find some sort of a target. For a while, they were considering a certain Colonel Stefanovic, who was anti-revolution, more pro-Austro-Hungary, and he'd recently become the Minister of War, and it was feared that he was going to dismiss various radicalized military officers from their rank. However, it was suddenly discovered that the Emperor Franz Joseph was going to be visiting Bosnia for a military parade on the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo, and that was considered to be the ideal time to strike. So this led to a whole series of new recruits coming out of the woodwork, And they were actually aided by the director of the Serbian military intelligence, because all these groups had been infiltrating the Serbian military or were very much infused within Serbian military. Even so, there were many individuals who truthfully were inspired by what must have been a highly emotional, romantic nationalism, but sometimes they were not always prepared for their role as assassins, which is often what they aspired to be. So when we get to the actual finale, the day that they were attempting to assassinate Franz Joseph and eventually did assassinate the emperor, there was one dramatic botched attempt that was made that was actually fairly darkly comedic. So there was this individual by the name of Avached, who really had the nerve and the desire to assassinate the Archduke. And he wanted to throw a grenade. So he did. He threw the grenade, but ultimately it missed its target. However, he had agreed to end his life if captured, and he was standing in the middle of a crowd, so obviously he was going to get captured, and he had a cyanide capsule. So he took the cyanide capsule because he was resolute to really go through with this, but he ended up getting very sick from the poison. So he couldn't keep the pill down. So then he decided that he was going to drown himself in a nearby river. Unfortunately, there was a drought that year, and so the river was too shallow. So he wasn't able to either take the cyanide or drown himself in the river, so he ended up being arrested. So it was quite a darkly comedic scene. Now, at this point, the Archduke was delivered to safety. And there was a discussion that obviously the situation was dangerous and the Archduke needed a security detail. But he decided that he wanted to show the Serbs his good faith. So even before the security detail was ready, because the security detail was available, however, you have to understand that back in those days, decorum was very important. The security detail was not properly dressed, and therefore they were not ready in time for the Archduke to go out into the crowd. So, of course, there should have been a delay, but the Archduke didn't want to delay matters, and so foolishly he rushed back out into the crowd. He took his carriage and he went back out into the royal procession. And of course, who was waiting there for him but this princep, who was very fanatical and who had a gun and fired at the Archduke, fired into the carriage, and shot not only the Archduke but also his wife Sophie. And as it turned out, both the Archduke and also Sophie died as a result of the shooting. Now, the ironic thing about this is that the Archduke was not prejudiced against Slavic people. In fact, his wife Sophie was Czech, and she, as you can tell by the fact that she didn't even have any kind of a title, she was a much lower rank from the Archduke. So really, in that sense, there is some irony there. Now, Serbia was given several ultimatums. They were told to put an end to all the saber rattling. They were told to dismantle this people's defense group that they had. And they had to suppress all these subversive movements. Now, Serbia was only ready to do the minimum with regard to this agreement or treaty that they were trying to have. And this would set off a secret treaty of 1892 that Serbia had made with Russia. Now, historians think that even without the assassination, the First World War would have happened anyway, but certainly the Black Hand And all of this various activism within Serbia was certainly a catalyst for the First World War, which actually ended up being unfortunate. So I thought this was an interesting topic because you so seldom get the details of the assassination of the Archduke. So again, this was the Black Hand, and it's a history of the secret Serbian nationalist group. It's a very long title, actually, and it's by a group called the Charles River Editors. So I thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this discussion. Have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
They say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some will mind it breaks.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from North Dakota by Fargo. It's a little chilly up here in the 20s. No biggie. This time I thought I'd talk about technology. I know a lot of you guys are big into electronic devices and got to have your new iPhone and or the latest, greatest in gizmos. And I see a lot of you going down the road. Texting while you're driving, not a good thing. Put down the damn phone. You'll live longer that way. A lot of you that probably say you're gonna but aren't gonna make your scouting trip or your migration up here to the homeland and stuff. Technology's great. It can help you get across the country, and you can hear my poopy dog in the background here barking at a dog across the way. But anyway, some of you, I don't know why, but you have to have that stupid cell phone GPS part of it on to find your way across town to get you home or to the corner store or to the mall or wherever. It's one of those, holy hell, you live there, yet you need a GPS to get you there? I think y'all need to go and get it together and learn your way around without the technology, because if it craps out, how the heck are you going to find your way home or to the store without your GPS? I can get across country quite easily without my GPS. I mean, it's a nice thing to have, but I don't need it. Here lately, mine has a tendency to lock up, and one time I let it go 24 hours, and I was like four states away before it finally reset and figured out that I wasn't where I was when it locked up. Did I need it to get across the country, continue my route? Obviously not. There's a thing called road atlases and maps. Funny thing about it, you know, our ancestors managed to get all the way across the country without really roads like we know it now. They were using wagon trails, game trails. I mean, Lewis and Clark managed to get all the way from, what was it, around the Chicago or St. Louis area where they started off from, all the way up to the homeland and back. And they didn't even have maps. They were just following the rivers and game trails and stuff. And they managed to make it all the way across the country and back again. But you people can't? Not even for a lousy little itty-bitty, like, vacation scouting trip combination? Give me a break. Don't badmouth Andy about replaying past episodes, because hey, there's a lot of good information, and obviously a lot of you haven't gone back and listened to all the back episodes yet, so keep up the good work, Andy.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Pennsylvania. Happy New Year, and hopefully you'll all make your scouting trip out here to the homeland this year. Be a novel concept. Yeah, I really think y'all should go and get off your asses and at least make a scouting trip. I mean, you can go and wrap it into a vacation or just take some time off and get off your ass and do it. Now, the roads are still open. There's no roadblocks. There's no police checkpoints other than, you know, on holidays with DUI pullovers and stuff. But really shouldn't be drinking and driving anyway. Be a novel concept if you actually came out here and saw what the area is like. It's pretty nice if you stay off the I-5 corridor. A little bit of the I-91 over there by Spokane is kind of filled up too, but you get off the big road, like say I-5 or I-90, like 5 to 10 miles off of the interstate, sometimes not even that far, things change one hell of a lot. You don't have as many yuppie suburban driving liberal retards driving around in their boober suits and all that kind of crap. This load I'm under right now to deliver in the morning here in Pennsylvania came out of Centralia, Washington, rather than have to put up with the stupid, retarded, idiot Seattle drivers that were headed up to play in the snow up there on I-90, it's Snoqualmie Pass. I decided to go over White Pass, which was a few miles farther for me, but yeah, and it's two lane. But hey, one, at that point in time, it was a traction tires were required. Everything except for four-wheel drives had to be chained up to go over Snoqualmie Pass. And at that point in time, White Pass was traction tires. Well, by the time I got up there anyway, it was advised the trucks were still required to chain when I checked. But when I got up there, didn't have to go and throw any iron because the road was basically bare and wet, and it didn't start snowing again until after I crested the summit. So that was a good thing. Yeah, it was really nice, like coming through, I think it was Randall, Washington. The truck ahead of me, the chip truck, ended up slamming on its brakes real quick, and I had to go and get slowed down before I wasn't tailgating him or anything or following too close, but he did a rapid slowdown. Why? Because some rodents wandered out into the road in front of him, and he decided he didn't want to hit the elk that were going from one grazing area on one side of the road to the other. So, yeah, I guess he wanted his front end and hood intact and stuff, so he didn't feel like hitting them. But, yeah, it's really scenic. Saw a lot of property for sale on both sides of the road going up over US 12 there at White Pass. Some houses, some commercial property for sale. So I don't know what the prices were on them, but hey, that's what the internet's for. Check it out. But there's nothing beats a good boots on the ground scouting trip. So that should be your New Year's resolution for this year. In my humble opinion, get off your ass and make your scouting trip.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Chaska, Minnesota. Delivering a load over here, and then got to run up to St. Cloud to pick up another load going to California. But I don't know if the government shutdown is going to be over by the time you hear this or not. But what if it lasts long enough to maybe affect the moochers, the people that do the snap cards, that kind of crap, getting the EBT or whatever the hell you call it. Granted, not all of them are moochers, but a lot of them, I guess, are getting benefits they shouldn't be receiving. What happens if it gets cut off like it did a few years ago in a couple selected cities? And what would you end up doing in that situation? How would that affect you if the primates went wild and you called 911 for help because they're trying to break into your house or assaulting you in your vehicle out on the street near where they got pissed off because they got turned away because their benefits weren't there? What then? And you called 911 and nobody answered. You say, no, trucker, that could never happen. 911 always answers. Well, here last week in Washington, Oregon, and I think it was Massachusetts and a few other states, the 911 system was down because CenturyLink dropped the ball. So what are you going to do then? Are you going to then cry out for help for the police? But how are you going to get a hold of them? Do you have their phone number on speed dial? Are they even going to come if you call, because, hey, they may be busy elsewhere. What if this is happening in a bunch of different areas across the country, or around your area, or whatever? Or if it's a nationwide 911 shutdown, and the primates went wild, what happens if it was a planned attack, and they shut down the 911 system, and they ended up head coordinated to all take advantage of that at the same time? Then you're screwed. So that's just something to think about. Yeah, it's hypothetical, but hey, you go and put a few key events together at the same time, and that might end up happening. Who knows? Just something to think about. If you are in a big city or live near one, you might want to go and look into residing in a smaller community. Or better yet, hey, this homeland thing ain't too bad of an idea. You wouldn't have to put up with the primates then. So, might be a good time to go and look into making your scouting trip, your migration, and all that soon before my little speculation comes to fruition. So anyway, all right, this is the Trucker signing off in Minnesota. Have a good one, comrades, and hope to see you out there on the road making your scouting trips and your migration soon.
They say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch a bandit run.
I want to talk to you folks now about a phenomenon within the movement known as running away to join the circus. It's a problem that we don't have as much these days as we used to have, since circus-type groups are far more rare than they used to be, but nonetheless, it still happens on occasion. This is an email from one of our comrades in Idaho called Alaska Mike. Greetings, Harold. Okay, now that you're back, a couple of moderately important points. An update on Comrade X, and by the way, I'm not going to name this guy because it's not my intention to embarrass this man, and I certainly don't want to point him out to the system any more than he already is now. Anyway, back to Alaska Mike's email. He has joined a different KKK group out of Pennsylvania, and they protested at a taco stand in Aryan Nations-style uniforms that displayed an anti-Aryan Nations sign in Coeur d'Alene on Friday. I guess he's referring to the taco stand that had the anti-Aryan Nations sign. And they got a 15-second blurb on the Spokane ABC affiliate Friday evening, and the SPIC closed down for the day. They're also going to protest against Martin Luther King on his day. Anyway, I've been in a bad mood for a week because of my inability to get this person aboard the Northwest Imperative Program. He says he wants to be in a group that does something, and I can't complain about that. And other than our organizing and networking, I couldn't give him any specific plan. I may well have missed it, but how about giving us some activism stuff suggestions? No costumes and streetwalking is more limited. No bridges have been burned, and someone with people skills, unlike a reclusive old coot sniper technocrat like me, could still bring them aboard. He does know a lot of local racialists, is in the homeland, and wants to be active, and so could be a valuable asset. Signed, Alaska Mike. In other words, this gentleman in Idaho has done what we call running away to join the circus. He has put on a costume and made a clown out of himself. He has also made sure that if the local police didn't know about him beforehand, which, as it happens, they did, because I know this man did something prior to this to obtain publicity, and then they damn sure know about him now. Now, this gentleman has now placed himself on the police lists, and if from now on anything should happen in northern Idaho, like some idiot skinhead throwing rocks through a synagogue window, or spray painting a Jewish community center, or even worse, kicking over headstones in a Jewish cemetery, or hanging a toy monkey where a nigger can see it, that kind of thing, if and when that happens, this gentleman who picketed the taco stand will have cops on his doorstep first thing, pressuring him to talk to them and cooperate and name names. Now, if that happens, he'll have reporters coming around to his house as well at all hours when they're short of a story, and they'll be shoving cameras in his face when he steps outside. Now, this gentleman may be one of these exhibitionists who seeks out this kind of notoriety, but he's going to find, as I found back in 1979 and 1980 when I had my 15 minutes, that this bullshit gets old very fast. I can't recall if Alaska Mike ever mentioned to me what this man's job is, but I think he may be in for an unpleasant surprise once he starts getting media publicity. This man may believe that he has a good relationship with his boss and that his job is secure. Well, it may be. Let's give it 6 months and see how his employer responds to the kind of pressure that can be brought against any North Idaho company employing a known racist. Pressure from the Jews, pressure from the Chamber of Commerce, pressure from the cops, pressure from the big real estate developer, Tim, who was largely responsible for the attack on Pastor Butler because he was worried that the presence of the Aryan Nations would lower his extensive commercial property values. But I understand the frustration and the attitude about, oh, Harold, the Northwest Front ain't doing nothing. Gotta do something, gotta do something, gotta jump up and down and shit snowballs. Doesn't matter, just gotta do something. I get it all the time. People who are so desperate to get some kind of feeling of accomplishment, to find some way to fast forward the tape, are so desperate to do something that they end up doing the wrong thing, or perhaps a better way to put it would be that they end up doing the same thing that we have been doing for the past 70 years and which does not work worth a damn. This movement of ours suffers from an almost fatal lack of imagination. When push comes to shove, usually all we can think of to do is dress up in a costume and stand on a street corner with a sign in our hands, thus allowing the local police and media to get our picture and our license number and making sure that whatever use we might be in the future as a public spokesman, we are now useless as a serious revolutionary because the police know who we are. Standing on a street corner wearing some kind of strange garb and holding a sign is kind of a political suicide as far as serious revolution goes. It takes you out of the game. And now, let me digress a bit here. Before some moron, cognitive dissonance agent on Facebook or Occidental Dissent leaps onto the internet screaming that this is a contradiction of a post I made on Facebook about a week or so ago. That post was about anonymous trolls. This is a case of apples and oranges. I was talking there in that post about trolls on the internet who hide behind false names in order to stir and to make trouble, i.e. Cass Sunstein's employees and ADL internet spooks like the ones who follow me around cyberspace in order to do harm to me and to the Northwest. I'm referring here in this podcast to real white people in the real world who seriously want to bring about change and who do need to protect their identities. It's nothing to do with the internet. The people I'm referring to are real. The internet trolls are not. The internet and real-world political activity have nothing to do with each other. Apples and oranges. Okay, let me explain a few things here. One of the racially conscious community's most durable and sacrosanct sacred cows is the street walk, otherwise known almost always incorrectly as a demonstration or a rally. 18 people do not constitute a rally of any kind, although the Jew and the scumbag counter demonstrations are often sufficiently large to merit that designation. Before we go any further, I need to add here, by way of full disclosure, that for the first 8 years or so of my racial career, I wore a costume myself. So I've been there and I've done that, but I grew out of it. One of the signs of political maturity in a movement person is when you finally realize that it isn't a uniform, it's a costume. Took me 8 years to realize that, but then I'm a slow learner. Streetwalking in its present racial form in America, we're not talking about Europe here, Europe's a totally different kettle of fish, but streetwalking in America goes back to the famous Commander George Lincoln Rockwell and his early stormtrooper activities in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. Since Rockwell was so far head and shoulders above everyone else that the movement has subsequently produced by way of leadership, self-appointed or otherwise, it's understandable that a lot of misconception and distortion has attached itself to the Rockwell legend. And one of the more unfortunate beliefs that has embedded itself in our little subculture from the Rockwell era is this concept of the minuscule activity on public property where we don't control access or security or anything, and we go out dressed in some kind of odd garb or costume. And yet this has become kind of a defining rite of passage or manhood ritual. Are you a coward if you don't stand out on a street corner wearing a costume and let people throw rocks at you? Now, this is a complete incorrect reading of George Lincoln Rockwell's tactics, which, just as much as Weimar, were distinct and particular to his time and place, a time and place that is now half a century distant. What Rockwell did during Phase 1 was a temporary set of tactics, not a strategy, which Rockwell himself defined repeatedly and very clearly as publicity stunts to be used only during the earliest phases of the ANP's struggle. These publicity stunts, this whole Phase 1 thing, has become a kind of cult among racially aware whites. Nonetheless, streetwalking is still with us. Let me explain the official rationale behind streetwalking point by point. Streetwalking, in theory, is essentially an attempt to reproduce here in America certain specific objective conditions which apply to Europe today, or which have applied to Europe in the past, or which to a limited extent used to apply to America in a largely idealized and incorrectly remembered past. I'm talking about things like the 50,000-man Klan marches in the 1920s, so forth and so on. More specifically, streetwalking is an attempt to replicate here in the 21st century certain key periods in European history that provided windows of opportunity for revolution, specifically Weimar Germany of the 1920s and 1930s, and to a lesser extent, Petrograd in 1917 if you're a leftist. And by the way, lefties have this same obsession as well with running around in the streets. It's a form of what anthropologists call sympathetic magic. The belief is that if we emulate the behavior of certain political movements from these historical epochs and we put on an approximate pastiche of the costume of the period, then somehow the year 2011 will become these historical epochs. Now, here's how it's supposed to work in theory. Number one, we begin with a small number of people, mostly socially dysfunctional young men, plus a few older right-wing cranks like me. Guys, I'm sorry, but those of you who have actually attended these gigs, you're going to recognize the truth of what I say here. Now, this small handful of people then goes out in public, often oddly dressed and waving signs and flags from the various historical epochs that they're trying to invoke, and under the protection of the police, of the very government that they are supposedly trying to oppose and replace. They exchange shouts and shoves, and they throw things at the Reds and the Mud People and the Bugger Boys. And in actual fact, of course, most of the throwing of stuff is usually done by the enemy. And more often than not, our people come back from these activities with their robes and their costumes covered with filth. Now, secondly, this street theater generates establishment media publicity, which, according to Orthodox movement thinking, is the be-all, the end-all, and the absolute lifeblood of our struggle. According to this school of thought, to be on TV is to be real. That's the goods. That's the real stuff, the right stuff. True, we can usually get a few sound bites on the 6 and 11 o'clock news with these activities, and sometimes a couple of hourly mentions on CNN and a few mangled newspaper quotes as well. In theory, other white people will see all this publicity, they'll admire the hell out of us, and they'll all come clamoring to join our little group and go on the next such activity. Now, here's where the whole concept starts to slip, but let's leave that for later. With every new streetwalk, there will, in theory, be more and more white people wearing the costumes and waving the signs and the flags and screaming and shouting at the Reds and the Bugger Boys and the Muds. And eventually, there will be thousands more of us, and we will outnumber the scum. And then somehow, we magically skip over the next 20 or so steps. Revolution will automatically occur just because we have a few thousand more people walking down the street. And then we can all go back home, plop down on the sofa, pop the top on a cold one, and turn on the TV for the rest of our lives. Now, up to this point, all of this stuff is theoretically possible. And yes, I'm well aware that on a handful of occasions, like Gage Park in 1966 and Marquette Park in 1970 in Chicago and Glenn Miller's White Patriot Party, Forsyth County, Georgia, so forth and so on, we've even gotten to within faintly audible shouting distance of this point on the horizon. Now, I know because I was there for some of these events, and yes, it is possible for us to occasionally work up a fairly big crowd. Now, on those few occasions when we have reached that point, the whole project has always fallen apart due to one of two causes. First off, there's the issue of our own character, which we as a community steadfastly refuse to confront. Glenn Miller's a good example here. Then there's also the complete and total lack of anything remotely resembling a plan to transmute large gatherings of racially aware whites into a political force that will transfer state power from the hands of those who presently hold it into our own. But usually the process is broken down long before at step three. The necessary connection isn't made in the minds of the white masses. The necessary desire to emulate and to join the streetwalkers never makes its appearance. Why not? Well, there are two reasons for this. First off, there's the fact that the Zog media controls what, if anything, the white community is allowed to see and hear of such activities. Like all serious stories nowadays, we are presented, whenever we go out in public, not as news, but as entertainment, which is what the masses expect now from television.
Look at the funny racists in the funny clothes. Oh, isn't that cute? Now stay tuned for American Idol.
Now, does this mean that we would get any better results if all the streetwalkers wore suits and ties? No, because secondly, there is again that issue of white character, which we refuse to address. The uncomfortable fact that we never want to deal with when we're doing this streetwalking mess as a substitution for action is that the overwhelming majority of white people are simply morally incapable of giving us the kind of reaction that we want from them. We are speaking to their grandfathers when we do this kind of thing, not to them. Modern-day Beavis and Butthead are a moral void. It is useless to appeal to the nobler natures and better instincts of the white majority. They have none. They've been deliberately made that way. They will never respond to any kind of mass movement tactics because the necessary moral instincts, frames of reference, and cultural motivations have been socially engineered out of them. We are beating a dead horse trying to use mass tactics. Okay, now that's streetwalking in theory, but what are we really doing here? Attendez-vous, guys. Let's start with a little history lesson. Now, the core of this belief system is that rather than actually fighting and killing our enemies, as was the case throughout thousands of years of Aryan history, real white men, quote-unquote, now display their macho and their physical prowess by symbolic gesture and a kind of mock ritual combat, kind of like New Guinea headhunters or gorillas and chimpanzees in a zoo. This role-playing ritual includes dressing up in strange, historically apocryphal clothing like homemade costumes patterned after the SA uniforms of the Third Reich, historically inaccurate Ku Klux Klan robes of purple and bilious green, and more recently we've got shaven heads with body tattoos. Let's be honest, some of these so-called right-wing and racist outfits look really absurd. Those of you who remember Andrew Greenbaum's uniformed branch, quote-unquote, for the Knights of Freedom from about 12 years ago, recall that they resembled the village people. On the street, there's a lot of bellicose chanting and shouting and threats and slogans. We're like gorillas beating our chests, the hurling of rocks and bottles, and that can be painful, but so far never lethal. There's the mock half charges and the aggressive posturing, etc. In some respects, it's remarkably similar to the ritualistic but almost completely non-fatal quote-unquote wars between tribes of New Guinea headhunters, where they all line up in a meadow and they yell and scream and ook-ook at each other and they, you know, make these little rushes and wave their little wooden spears and then they all go back and have a feast. And it seems to serve a similar purpose. You know, we have the bonding feast afterwards at the local Howard Johnson's or, you know, McDonald's or whatever. And wearing big tankards of ale are hoisted, and the enemy are all held to scorn, and boasts of great deeds of battle done during the day are proclaimed, etc., etc. Now, the participants in these streetwalking activities have come through an event which generated an adrenaline and pheromone rush similar to that produced by an actual battle, but with none of the risks. They can subsequently feel the sense of accomplishment and the increased self-esteem that comes from the illusory idea that they've fought back, that they're in the trenches and they're frontline soldiers. And this, I think, is the main attraction of streetwalking. It gives an inflated and false high, a feeling of self-esteem, a feeling that you really did something when in fact you didn't. You notice that no one is ever actually hurt. Not a single weapon is fired, no physical damage of any kind is inflicted on the enemy, and on Monday morning, everybody trudges back to their shit work jobs, and all is as it was. Nothing changes, and everybody's happy. Now, on a few occasions, actual combat does break out, more by accident than anything else, but it's always short and it's quickly broken up by the police. And then there are legal consequences, which far outweigh any advantage to be gained. Greensboro and the Palmer House in Chicago in 1977 are good examples of this. Now, before somebody starts yelling about November the 3rd, it needs to be very clearly understood that Greensboro was an accidental exception, totally sui generis, totally on its own. And we should note that it has not been allowed to happen again, thank God. No one but an idiot would want to go through the years that followed Greensboro as the lives of 16 innocent men were utterly destroyed by this society's obscene judicial process. The actual chance of anyone getting seriously hurt on one of these street walks beyond a few bruises is slim. The police are always out in force, and usually they more or less do their jobs and prevent the tiny handful of whites from being lynched by the lefty muddy mobs. There have been some nasty incidents at some of these events when they've been allowed to get out of hand, or when the police are absent through design or incompetence, but even when that happens, there's never any serious threat to the power structure. If there were, the police would be breaking up such gatherings with rubber bullets and nightsticks and not guarding us. In essence, streetwalks are a psychological substitute for actual physical resistance against the tyranny that's destroying our race. It's rather like professional wrestling, ritualized mock combat that allows for a certain level of self-esteem in those who participate in these things. It's like exchanging insults and maybe a few shoves and pokes with scum is in some way equivalent to actual serious resistance, which threatens the power structure. Now, an interesting thing I noticed when I was in Ireland. Now, while Sinn Féin, the legal arm of the Provost, does hold demonstrations regularly in Dublin and Belfast and other places, in the first place, Sinn Féin has the many thousands in numbers that are needed to do it right. And secondly, the actual volunteers of the IRA are under orders to stay away from such events to prevent their being photographed or arrested. The only exceptions used to be firing parties at Republican funerals, although I understand the Provost stopped doing that because it's too risky. Now, in some ways, this cult of false macho is perfectly understandable in view of the extreme rarity of physical courage among white males these days. I don't deny a certain limited value in these events. In the absence of a better rite of passage for young white men, this will have to do for the time being. Although, frankly, I think a better rite of passage for young white men would be learning a trade and raising a family in the homeland. But I have to admit, I like my own little aphorism about this. A white man of 20 who doesn't streetwalk has no balls. If he's still doing it when he's 40, he has no brain.
This show's obviously running long, and I badly structured it because I'd intended to run other material but didn't get to it. There are a couple comrades who are helping me with editing, and I had them do some last-minute things, which I clearly did not use, and I owe you both an apology. Sorry, guys. We'll definitely get that stuff in next time. Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Freedom.
Of the rising of the moon.